Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes, intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field. This week, we have a long overdue episode with one of my mentors from medical school, Dr. Ahmad Kandel, and he gives us a rundown of thyroid disease. Coming up soon, we have a whole series of podcasts going over oral boards, everything from the logistics to test taking and to practice scenarios. I think everyone will find that very helpful, whether you have mock orals coming up or the actual oral exam. So if you have any questions specifically about the exam, any concerns, tweet it at us and we will ask our host, Dr. Blatnick, to help break that down for us. Enjoy the episode. Okay, welcome Behind the Knife. Today we're here at Tulane University with one of my medical school mentors, Dr. Ahmad Kandel. He is an associate professor of surgery and chief of endocrine surgery and chair in surgical oncology at Tulane. And today he's going to talk to us a little bit about thyroid disease. Dr. Kandel, welcome Behind the Knife.
Well, thank you very much for having me today.
So we're just going to jump right into it, sir. And can you just tell us a little bit? I know you've been all over New York, Hopkins, Egypt. Can you just tell us kind of the path that you that got you to be chair at Tulane?
Well, I'm a chair in surgical oncology. So this is endowed chair. I was a foreign grad. So there is always a hope for foreign grads to be surgeons in this great country. So I was able to get into surgical residency after doing a few years of research at NYU, and then was able to get into a preliminary program. Then I believe I worked as hard as I can, eventually went to the lab after a couple of years of preliminary surgery, and finally I was honored to get the categorical spot. My chairman, Michael Zimmerman, offered me the spot with my program director, Dr. Schwarzman. So anyway, I was able to make it, finish my training at SUNY Downstate, and then I was able to get a fellowship at Johns Hopkins, and I'm here right now at Tulane.
Great. How many years was that leading up to getting your categorical spot?
So I would say maybe 5 years.
Wow.
It's a while.
Yeah, it's true dedication.
But I think it's worth it. I think it's if I had to do this again, I would do the same thing one more time. No? I mean, I feel I'm blessed to be where I am right now. I love what I do. So
great.
It's being tougher right now. So even for American grads, as you know, that there was a shortage in physicians, at least predicted shortage of physicians in 2020. So what they did, they increased the admission to the current medical schools and they increased the number of medical schools in general. So there was approximately 20% increase of the American medical graduates who started to graduate, I believe, like last year. And my understanding is approximately 2,000 American grads with no spot in the match this year. So it's getting really competitive. So, and what's really interesting that there were no plans to increase the residency spots. Additionally, I don't believe there will be any plans to increase the residency spots because the same survey that was done years ago to show that there will be a predicted need for more physicians showed recently that this was actually a mistake in the calculation and there will be not much of a need. Additionally, the current, proposed plan by the Obamacare and all this actually plan to decrease the number of residency spots. So there is no plans whatsoever to, my understanding, wow. At least there will be more spots that will be offered in any residency.
Sounds like a bottleneck. That's interesting.
Yeah.
So, sir, for our listeners here, Dr. Kandel has pioneered the way in robotic thyroid in the United States, robotic thyroid surgery. And if you could just tell us a little bit about what it's like being the starting a new way of doing things and kind of how that experience has been.
So we have done here at Tulane the largest number of robotic thyroid surgery in the country, and we do have the largest experience in the robotic thyroid surgery. However, this was really pioneered in Yonsei University in Seoul in South Korea. Eventually, Professor Chung came to the United States and taught the American surgeons how to do it, and we were one of the first centers that jumped onto this and eventually did most cases in the United States. We did have patients coming from all over the country and from actually all over the world, but right now there are more centers doing it in Europe and in South America, and so the volume that used to come is significantly lower. Additionally, there are some restrictions from the FDA on the robotic thyroid surgery, which we just recently had a paper that was accepted on thyroid that talked about there was an extensive increase on the adoption of robotic thyroid surgery, and after the FDA restriction, the number significantly plummeted down. So we presented this also in the American Thyroid Association meeting, where you, Kevin, did a great oral presentation there years ago. So it's something that's technically difficult, and honestly, it should be only done by surgeons who had high volume thyroid surgery and should not be done by the occasional thyroid surgeon. You see, Kevin, the problem here in the United States, the vast majority, over 95% of thyroid surgery done in this country are done by occasional thyroid surgeons who perform less than 5 a year. So it's not fair for physicians who are performing less than 5 a year to jump on trying to perform more of these advanced procedures.
Great. Well, with that, we're going to jump right into the dissection of the day. And as you were saying, you do a lot of thyroids, and not all of them, most of them not robotically.
Absolutely, most of them not robotically. We only offer the robotic thyroid surgery right now for young female patients that are really concerned and interested in avoiding visible neck scar and have significant interest in cosmesis. Yes.
So, sir, we're going to use your vast experience in thyroid disease, and if you can just take us through the standard patient. So you have a 40-year-old lady that comes into your office, and she's told by her primary care that she has a thyroid nodule. And I was wondering if you could just talk us through the FNA, how you do this, and kind of the pathways that lead you.
So when you have a patient with thyroid nodule, you want to rule out if this is malignant or not, and you want to also rule out if there is a functional thyroid nodule or functional thyroid. So as we always teach our students and residents, the most important thing you need to start with history and physical to rule out symptoms of hypo or hyperthyroidism. Also ask about family history of thyroid cancer or a family history suggestive of thyroid cancer, parathyroid disease, or adrenal problems, or if they have any possible history of metastatic disease like cough, hemoptysis, focal bone pain, or other symptoms that can suggest metastatic disease, which is really uncommon. So after you do your history and physical, it's a good idea to always do a thyroid function test to see if this is a functional gland or not functional gland. Makes a significant difference in the decision making also, even if it's not functional. Let's say that the patient had the Hashimoto thyroiditis and you have a suspicious nodule, then it will really make a difference about how you plan your operation. And then eventually, as we all know, that the standard of care, the gold standard to rule out cancer is fine needle aspiration biopsy. And so you perform the fine needle aspiration biopsy in the office, and I actually have a very busy ultrasound practice, and I perform all these in my office. And it's a simple procedure that you can literally do in a couple of minutes. So under ultrasound guidance, you use 25-gauge needle see where is the needle going, and do The idea is to keep a little bit of suction. We do not use this the special suction devices that been traditionally used by older physicians. Just a simple 25 gauge needle and a 10 cc syringe, and just simply core the nodule and then spread on a slide. In my practice, I do have a cytopathology technician on site to confirm the adequacy of the specimen, because as you can understand, it's not a good idea to the patient. You need to come back for a repeat biopsy. And, you know, ideally, you should have adequate sampling up to like 95-97% of the time. So non-diagnostic specimen should not be a common problem when you perform these procedures. I don't want to go into the details of fine needle aspiration biopsy, but I mean, simply you can do it with a little local or without local. There are two different schools in this, different schools in the size of the needle. I just mentioned that I use the 25 gauge needle. People can use a little bit larger or smaller size. Additionally, the use of gel, you want to make sure you don't use too much. But usually, it's very easy, simple thing. And I honestly think surgeons should learn this technique because it's a huge tool for us when we manage patient with metastatic disease to the cervical lymph nodes, or if the patient has a parathyroid disease and you want to use this really great tool in the OR to help you with your surgical planning. So after the fine needle aspiration biopsy, we either get from the pathologist that this is benign, which is most of the time, can be up to 80% of these fine needle aspiration biopsy will be benign.
Will they just say colloid or?
Yeah, so that's another important thing. They will say that there is maybe some follicular cells and or even Herthel cell metaplasia, but eventually they will tell you that this is a benign colloid nodule or benign follicular nodule. But it is under the category of benign. A very unfortunately common mistake, the surgeons, when they see the word follicular, they think it's follicular lesion or follicular neoplasm. But if I stick any thyroid, I should get follicular cells. But eventually the final diagnosis is to by the pathologist to document that this is a benign nodule. They actually have to see a specific number, like maybe most probably 10 groups of follicular cells to say that this is adequate sample. So if it's benign and not causing compressive symptoms and not enlarging, this is a patient that you do not offer an operation and you just observe. And it's controversial for how long you will need to observe these patients. But you might want to consider repeating the ultrasound a year after that, and if it's stable in size, no need for further follow-up. However, if there's an increase in size, you would consider repeating the biopsy. So that's for the benign category. For the malignant category, it can be maybe up to 5% of the fine needle aspiration biopsy. And depending on the size, you can plan your operation. So ideally, nowadays, we only biopsy nodules more than 1 centimeter. The 2012 guidelines from the American Thyroid Association had actually specific scenarios for nodules that less than a centimeter that can be considered for fine needle aspiration biopsy if the patient has a family history of thyroid cancer, calcification, etc. But the recent guidelines that are not out yet, but they should be out very soon, will say that we should not biopsy any nodule less than a centimeter. So if it's malignant and it's more than a centimeter, the standard of care is to consider performing a total thyroidectomy. However, it's a controversial topic again. Some people now will argue if it's a small nodule, young patient, maybe a lobectomy can be sufficient. But the standard of care is to perform a total thyroidectomy.
Right. And the benefits of the lobe is you're not putting the nerves at risk or the parathyroid on both sides.
Yeah, if you have a small cancer, you know, when you do a unilateral operation, you cut your risk literally to 50% instead of doing a bilateral surgery. So the risk of nerve injury, the risk of parathyroid problems, and we actually proved this by meta-analysis of the entire literature and by looking at the national database, we recently reported on this too. Yes, high volume surgeon will have significantly lower complication rate compared to low volume surgeon. However, if you look specifically into the outcomes of the high volume surgeons, when they perform a total thyroidectomy, they have a higher risk of complications compared to a thyroid lobectomy. You know, you can be a great surgeon, you think you're great, but really when you look at the data, that's not what the data show. We need to be very critical about that. Definitely as simple as this, simple statistics, you do the operation twice, literally by doing bilateral exploration, and you're literally increasing the risk of complication twice. At least that's what simply the data shows too.
Right. And so what are the exact indications that you would not offer someone a lobectomy for? What are some of the size and features? I know there's some characteristics on ultrasound possibly or on biopsy that would push you towards doing a total thyroidectomy.
So there are specific criteria in the thyroid nodule that will make you consider a fine needle aspiration biopsy. We talked about the size, more than a centimeter. Right. If there is calcification, there is an increased risk. If there is an increased internal vascularity or regular margins, if the nodule is taller than wider, that's a very high suspicious feature. Having said that, standard test is the fine needle aspiration biopsy. All these are suspicious ultrasound features, but you still need to perform the fine needle aspiration biopsy to get to the diagnosis. The interesting topic with the thyroid nodules, that the indeterminate category. So the indeterminate category will include atypia and follicular lesion of undetermined significance and follicular neoplasm. So when you perform a fine needle aspiration biopsy, 20 to 30% from the aspirations will come up with these indeterminate category. And that depends on the institution. And the risk of malignancy there is also depends on the institution experience, but it can range anywhere between 10 to 40%, depending on the category and depending on the institution. But traditionally, we used to offer these patients a diagnostic lobectomy for patients with indeterminate nodule. And we wait for the final path, because you cannot really rule out capsular invasion or lymphovascular invasion or fine needle aspiration biopsy, and you need to, or in frozen section, and you have to wait for the final path to make a decision if the patient will need a completion thyroidectomy versus just an observation and conservative management. However, nowadays there is a plethora of genetic testing in the market to examine if these nodules are high risk for malignancy or there is a very low risk for being malignant. And I don't want to go into the details of this because there is more and more data to show that what we really thought about these tests is not completely true, and there is more to come. Okay. And I still believe so far the standard of care is to perform a thyroid lobectomy. Having said that, in my own practice, we do perform the Afirma testing, and maybe in a high-risk patient with a benign Afirma, we will consider an observation. So it's helpful to in certain high-risk patients to try to avoid surgery with having these gene testing.
So, sir, can you just, you're kind of touching on it, the patient that you evaluate and decide, I think we've covered, if it's greater than 1 centimeter, they're definitely going to, you're going to offer them a total thyroidectomy. Is there anything on the FNA that comes back that would,
So, for example, sometimes if you have an FNA with, we do gene testing also on the fine needle aspiration biopsy for BRAF mutation. So if the BRAF mutation comes back positive, then we think about being more aggressive, than this patient definitely will need at least a total thyroidectomy. So sometimes you have an indeterminate nodule or suspicious nodule from malignancy. But if it is BRAF positive, then this is almost 100% a confirmatory test that this is cancer and you treat them as a cancer patient. So far, the rule, I mean, are we going to do more central dissection for patients with BRAF positive? Really, there is no strong data to support that. And there are two different school of thoughts on this. So let's just clarify what's central lymph node dissection first. So central lymph node dissection is basically removing all the lymphatic tissue from carotid to carotid, all the way to the hyoid bone, down to the sternal notch, or down to the innominate vessels. So you basically circumferentially dissect the recurrent laryngeal nerve, try to preserve your parathyroid glands, and sometimes you need to do autotransplantation of the inferior parathyroid glands because they get devascularized. It's an important thing that you always need to do a frozen section on parathyroid before any consideration for autotransplantation, because you don't want to autotransplant malignancy or malignant lymph node. So that's what central dissection means. But nowadays we need to clarify, are we doing a bilateral central lymph node or right or left? Are we doing prophylactic versus therapeutic? So if you do not have clinical evidence of metastatic disease in the central compartment or ultrasonographic evidence of positive disease in the central compartment, if you elect to perform central compartment dissection, you are actually performing a prophylactic operation, and this has to be clarified. And you might want to consider, according to at least the last guidelines that are available from 2012, for T3, T4, you might want to consider prophylactic central lymph node dissection if the nodule more than 4 centimeters. However, you can perform many of these central dissections for these large nodules, and there will be no metastatic lymph node. On the opposite side, maybe we all agree that there is a rule for therapeutic central lymph node dissection. Basically, if you have a very suspicious lymph node seen in the ultrasound, or intraoperatively you see these blue discolored lymph nodes and you know that this is metastatic disease, then there is a rule, and most probably this will decrease the recurrence. However, the jury is still out on the real benefit of central dissection, and people can argue both ways if there is a benefit or no. And there are different meta-analyses out there in the literature. And the truth is, it really depends at the end on where you trained and your personal experience. But what we know for a fact that there is a high risk of complications while performing central lymph node dissection. And the most common complication is hypoparathyroidism. I mean, obviously followed by recurrent laryngeal nerve injury.
And when identifying these suspicious nodes on ultrasound, is that done by an ultrasound tech and a radiologist identifying that, or is that just the surgeon performed ultrasound?
So most people, you depend on radiology for that. However, in my own practice, I actually perform my own comprehensive neck ultrasound. As per the ATE guidelines, the American Thyroid Association guidelines, every patient with papillary thyroid cancer should have a comprehensive neck ultrasound to rule out metastatic disease, because 40% of papillary thyroid cancer patients will have a metastatic lymph node. And it's a good idea to take care of these patients as early as possible instead of them going into multiple unnecessary operations. You see, what's really common in certain communities is that the patient will have a large nodule, they undergo a thyroid lobectomy because it's non-diagnostic, comes back as papillary thyroid cancer, and then the surgeon says, cancer, we need to take the wrist out. So they take the wrist of the gland out, and then they go and see the endocrinologist, and now they see another lymph node in the neck, and they call it recurrence. That's not recurrent. That was there from the beginning. Right. And that patient could easily had one good operation, total thyroidectomy, with central and possibly lateral neck dissection to clear the disease, and that could be a very curative operation.
Well, and we know one of the benefits of the total thyroidectomy is that you can do the completion iodine radiotherapy or iodine therapy.
So that's a very interesting topic. We used to teach our residents and students that there are 4 benefits of doing total thyroidectomy compared to thyroid lobectomy for thyroid cancer patients. Number one, Mazafari data showed that total thyroidectomy will have a lower recurrence rate compared to thyroid lobectomy. And there is possibly some survivor benefit, but at least there is a lower recurrence rate. Number two, there is possibly multifocal disease in the contralateral lobe. Number three is the need for radioiodine therapy, because everybody in the past used to get radioiodine therapy. In order to have some effect, you want to remove the whole thing, so you will use a smaller dose for microscopic disease. And number four is to follow up on recurrence using thyroglobulin level, serum thyroglobulin level, so you can find out or diagnose early recurrence as early as possible. Having said all these reasons, as for every reason I said, there is data against it. And you can literally follow up on small cancer on a young patient with just after thyroidlobectomy. Because if you think about it, when we perform neck dissection for recurrent disease, we have to have a positive fine needle aspiration biopsy of this suspicious lymph node. And if we do not have this, then we don't operate for thyroid cancer patient. So you can actually very carefully watch these patients. If they develop any suspicious lymph node, you biopsy, and then you can operate. Again, radioiodine therapy, at least in the upcoming guidelines, it's not going to be offered to everybody. They will have specific category for low risk, moderate risk, high risk. So if you have a young female patient, 30 years old, with 1 centimeter papillary thyroid cancer, no metastatic disease, she is not a candidate for radioiodine therapy. The data showed that there is no real benefit of doing radioiodine therapy. We need to understand that we learned recently more and more about the complication related to radioiodine therapy with secondary malignancy that can average around 1%. So in a very low risk patient, these patients might not need radioiodine therapy. So there is a lot of evolving topics in this area, specifically, you know, also more topics about, you know, when you do perform a total thyroidectomy, patient will be hypothyroid. And we know that 15% of women after total thyroidectomy, they will never feel normal again. So having thyroid hormones coming out of their own remaining lobe is a big deal for many patients. So the jury's still out there on these topics. But for the purpose of the exam, I would say a total thyroidectomy and consideration of central lymph node dissection if there is a grossly positive disease in the central compartment, and for the lateral neck dissection if there is a grossly enlarged lymph nodes or ultrasonographically suspicious lymph node with a fine needle aspiration biopsy, that's diagnostic for cancer. And interestingly enough, we know nowadays that thyroglobulin washout is a lot more sensitive on the fine needle aspiration biopsy compared to cytology.
Now, Dr. Candle is going to help us in the tips and tricks segment, and he's going to discuss to us how to avoid the recurrent laryngeal nerve in the parathyroid. As surgeons, this is our biggest fear, and we're tested on it a lot. What techniques do you use to identify the recurrent laryngeal nerve and avoid injuring it?
So, visualize the nerve and trying to avoid visualizing the nerve and staying on the capsule can be a very dangerous approach for thyroid surgery and can be associated with a complication that we all want to avoid. So the best way is to try to find the nerve. You can use some of the current technology with the nerve monitor, and there is a good amount of data on the literature to show the value of the nerve monitor. Until today, there is no data to show that the use of the nerve monitor will decrease the risk of complications. However, you can make important surgical decisions using this technology. So, for example, if you are operating on one side and you know that you lost a signal on that side, you have a nerve stretch, and you know that the nerve is intact, but you have a paresis and you lost a signal, and you confirm that your system is in a good shape and you troubleshoot the system, and you know definitely you have a paresis on the nerve, then it does not make sense to put your other nerve at risk for another possibility for paresis and end up tricking this patient. I mean, this patient can be just completely cured by the unilateral operation, that's a possibility. Or if you really have to go back again and do the other side, you can stage the operation and wait for the nerve to come back. And this can happen quickly, or it can take few months to for full recovery. And then you can take the patient back for completion thyroidectomy and to perform the operation on the contralateral side. But by using this technology, you can almost guarantee that you will nerve injury.
And so when you, how do you identify the recurrent laryngeal nerve? Do you start inferior? Do you?
So the nerve is identified medial to the inferior parathyroid gland. We look at it in the tracheoesophageal groove. We dissect it all the way up to the cricothyroid membrane. We also know that the nerve can branch maybe up to 50% of the time. So we need to really observe the branch, look for these branching and dissect very carefully these branches. And dissect the nerve all the way to the cricothyroid membrane so we can avoid the possibility that the nerve is, for example, stretched on the capsule and injure the nerve during the ligation or division of the ligament of Barrett. It's during the central dissection, the idea is to identify the nerve and circumferentially dissect it from all the lymphatic tissue, again into the tracheoesophageal groove all the way to the cricothyroid membrane. Using the nerve monitor can also help sometimes identify the non-recurrent laryngeal nerve that's usually on the right side prior to searching for it. So if you have a low latency, less than 2, while you stimulate the vagus nerve and the carotid sheath, you know that you're most probably dealing with non-recurrent laryngeal nerve. Granted that this is a very low incidence, it's less than 1%, but there's something that can absolutely help in these cases, so you can know that you're dealing with a non-recurrent laryngeal nerve that's going directly from the carotid sheath down to the cricothyroid membrane. The other important nerve that we really need to look for is the external branch of the superior laryngeal nerve, which can be easily injured with the larger goiters. There are different classifications for the location of the superior laryngeal nerve, but they are classified according to how far are they from the superior pedicle. And definitely if they are within a centimeter from the superior pedicle, the gland is very large and you have a high superior pole, you have a higher risk of injury of the external branch. And you want to really do your best to avoid that injury, because the injury of that nerve can cause issues also the quality of the voice and the lose of the high pitch of the voice.
Right. Okay, great. And now if you can, the other thing we want to avoid, one of the most talked about complications, this to prevent this problem?
So you need to know the anatomical location of the parathyroid glands, and they're usually located on the near behind the thyroid in the lower half of the thyroid, and they are very variable in the location in the neck. And the key is to preserve the vascularity of the gland and take your time trying to preserve the parathyroid glands. And if you have a devascularized gland during the operation, before you consider, you should consider doing autotransplantation. And before doing the autotransplantation, as I mentioned earlier, you should really consider doing a frozen section to make sure that whatever you're planning to auto-transplant is parathyroid and it's not a lymph node, for example. So that's really important. It's not a bad idea to examine your specimen at the end of the operation when you do a thyroid surgery to make sure there are no attached parathyroid glands. But usually experienced surgeons localize these during the operation and preserve them during the surgery, and do not need to worry about this. Having said that, even in the hands of the high volume surgeon, you can worry about transient hypoparathyroidism, and that's more common in scenarios like while performing central lymph node dissection or Graves' disease operation. And in these cases, there is very good data to show that checking the PTH level at the end of surgery can be helpful in predicting which patients will be hypoparathyroid or not. The most important thing here that if you're doing a lot of these operations, you can safely discharge patients home same day after surgery. This is again another controversial topic, but we have a statement from the American Thyroid Association going over the details of who should we and who should not we discharge same day of the surgery. We don't really just keep patients anymore in the hospital to monitor their calcium. And if you do the PTH at the end of the operation, you can rule out the possibility of significant hypocalcemia. And you literally tell them to take calcium if they have any numbness or lingering, and they all do well, as long as you know what you're doing and you preserve these parathyroid glands.
And so are you seeing all four parathyroids in every thyroidectomy that you're doing? Are you?
You try to, but... you know, there is actually a question in CSAB that you've seen three parathyroids and you don't see the fourth one, what would you do? And the answer is to do nothing.
Right.
So if you're just doing a thyroid surgery and you're missing one gland, you just do not need to worry about it. Stay in the capsule, make sure it's not removed with your specimen,
right,
and do not need to just keep looking for it. Thyroid adenoma, then you need to do the systematical approach for the search of the missing parathyroid gland.
And generally, the superior parathyroids are the more reliable location, is that?
Yeah, the superior are more reliable in their location, and less common to be in an ectopic position. But if they are in ectopic position, they will go to the posterior mediastinum and they can go behind the superior pole of the thyroid gland. The inferior one are the ones that are more valuable. 25% can be present in the thymus, and you have to do a thymectomy on the missing side to take care of that and find the culprit for the disease. And they can be retroesophageal, they can also be in the anterior mediastinum. The most common location of ectopic parathyroid glands are the missing inferior ones and the thymus gland.
And then just to wrap things up, can you take us through the situation when you would do an autotransplant and how you actually do that?
So, if you are doing, depends on the scenario. So if you're just doing a thyroidectomy and you have one parathyroid gland that looks devascularized to you and you're really considering doing the transplantation, so you want to send a little tiny piece to confirm that this is parathyroid tissue for frozen section. And then you dice after confirming that this is parathyroid tissue, you have to keep it on ice. And after that, you dice it into tiny small pieces and you... either can put it in a small pocket in the sternocleidomastoid muscle, or if you are operating on a dialysis patient, you can consider putting it on the brachioradialis muscle in the non-dominant hand, and just mark this with a clip, for example. The idea is to increase the surface area of the remaining parathyroid, so hopefully it will take and be good. If you are doing a total parathyroidectomy with autotransplantation for a secondary or tertiary hyperparathyroidism, or you are doing a subtotal parathyroidectomy and the remnant part of the parathyroid looks devascularized, you do the same thing. But the key here is you autotransplant approximately 50 milligram of the most normal looking parathyroid gland. You don't want to try to autotransplant to one of these large diseased glands in the scenarios with secondary or tertiary hyperparathyroidism.
Now we'll go into our final five. Do you listen to music in the operating room? And if so, what type?
So I just happened that I just received this article here about noisy OR linked to communications gaps and SSIs. So there is here a paper that showed that there is increase of infections in the operating room when surgeons listen to music. You know, this topic is of great interest to me, so we looked in the literature trying to do some analysis about what's published, and it's a very controversial topic, and we currently putting a survey to the American head and neck surgeons to just survey about who does listen and what they think about music in the operating room. I think it's a very controversial topic. To me, I feel that I concentrate more when there is no music, and I prefer to have a quiet OR so I can listen to my residents and students and be able to teach. I just think there are other places for music, and the OR is not one of them.
So, sir, do you have any interests, talents, or something you like to do outside of the operating?
I like to ride the bike, so I just a few months ago I've done the century, and I'm trying to do more. And just it's great to live in New Orleans and enjoy the levee, enjoy the lake, and have a nice ride. You can easily go and do like a nice 40 miles on a Saturday. Or
what kind of bike are you riding?
A good bike. I want
Okay, can you tell me about one of your favorite trips or vacations you've been on?
That's a very good question. So I travel a lot, but I've been to many great places, many great countries. For sure, what I like is different from what my kids like. I've been to Orlando many times, and I'm going very soon to take the kids for another vacation, but definitely Orlando is not one of them. If I go there more frequently, but I really enjoyed my trip to Paris. I was invited there to participate in one of a robotic symposium, and we toured Paris, and I did absolutely enjoy South France, and enjoyed Nice. I mean, I love this area.
Okay.
I mean, I've been invited a few times to Dubai. I enjoy really visiting Dubai. Just I like the different things there, and the food, and the variety of things. I'm supposed to choose three.
No, that's plenty.
That's great, yeah.
And so, number four, if you did not become a surgeon, what do you think you'd be doing nowadays?
I'd like to be doing something good. I've been thinking about this, actually, now more often, and wanted to know what I'm going to do when I stop doing surgery. So I love science, and I think I'm going to continue to do science even if I'm just retired from operating. And I have a lab. We do basic science research, and I just love the environment of teaching and science and education. I just love that. So I think I'm going to hopefully keep doing this for a while. But additionally, I would love to get more involved with more humanitarian activities, and I've been thinking about what should I really do more and more in the next few years and for the rest of my life. I mean, I enjoy surgery, but I don't think I'm going to keep doing this for a very, very long time, and I want to do other useful things.
Great. Now, if you could go, our last question, number five, if you go back to your first day of internship, and tell yourself one piece of advice, what piece of advice would you give yourself?
So what I really learned from my first day of internship, that a human being have too many qualities and a lot of energy that he rarely use. So I used to believe that I work really hard, and I'm just a hard-working person. But when I was on call for the first day, and I found out that I just continued to the next day 36 hours nonstop, and I think maybe definitely more than 36 hours in all days. I felt that, you know, and I just kept going. I mean, I felt like we can do more than we can expect to ourselves to do. And, you know, after that, we did the power calls and doing every other day on call and without sleeping at night, having very busy calls. We just have too much energy in us that we, I believe, we underutilize, and we should really keep more attention to this and try to get the best out of us and help ourselves and help the people that we love.
So basically, residents now are soft.
I'm not saying that. I'm just saying it's just you learn from your surgical experience that you can do things that you never thought that you would do. If you talk to any of your friends, when they talk about they stay 24 hours without sleeping, it's like a big, huge deal. I mean, it's not uncommon for a surgeon to just keep working for 2 days without a call.
Just keep putting one step in front of the other and keep working hard.
I'm not saying it's a very safe thing or we should do that, but we definitely had a lot of energy in us that we absolutely underutilize.
Definitely. Well, and Dr. Candle just found out today that he won the award for the best surgical educator in the hospital. So, and that's not a surprise to me, as I chose him because he's very personable and a great teacher. So congratulations on that,
sir. Thank you very much, Kevin. It's a great honor to work with somebody like you, and I look forward to see you up there. And I'm proud of you, and I'm confident that you will be a leader in this field.
Until next time, dominate the day.